Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm just really, really honored to have as my guest today one of the top historians of our era, who's written over 30 books. And our topic is his latest book, which is a very, very timely exploration of a key issue facing us now in our lifetimes. The book is called America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War. And my guest is H.W. Brands, who teaches at the University of Texas, Austin. Dr. Brands, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
You know, I don't think I've ever had a book impact me like this in that, you know, we go through our educations, and I had a good education, and you're just taught, you know, you go through the deep Great Depression, FDR's election, the New Deal, World War II, and the opposite argument to entering World War II is given kind of short shrift. And you really give it a deep exploration here, which really gave provided the intellectual foundation for it, which I think is a deep service to our country as we're facing these debates again. Can you start out by just kind of providing that our country really was non-interventionist throughout our history leading up to that time?
No, not at all. In fact, for nearly all of the century and a half between American independence and the late 1930s, Americans were convinced that the interests of their country lay precisely in not getting involved in other people's wars. There had been one big exception to this, but this was the exception that proved the rule, namely when America got involved in World War I. Americans initially steered clear of the First World War, but gradually things drew the United States in, and the United States entered, and 200,000 Americans died in that war. And at the end of the war, Americans quickly became convinced that the effort had been for no good purpose at all. Europe remained as divided, remained as prone to war after the war as it had been before. Woodrow Wilson, the American president, had promised that this was a war to make the world safe for democracy. He said this was the war that would end all war. And it did neither of those things. And Americans, by the mid-1920s, they thought this had been a grave mistake. By the mid-1930s, when the United States was in the middle of its depression and had all the more reason to attend to things at home, Americans overwhelmingly were of the opinion that should Europe foolishly go to war again, the United States must not be as foolish as before and should not join. This reached the point where Congress passed a series of laws called the neutrality laws that mandated neutrality in case of a future war, that handcuffed the president who might otherwise be tempted to draw the United States closer to war. And when war broke out in Europe on September 1st, 1939, when the Second World War broke out, Americans remained overwhelmingly opposed to the idea that the United States should enter that new war.
You know, this book covers the period between 1939, 1941, roughly. And, I'm a big fan of FDR. I've always felt he was one of our best presidents. But you read where he's one of the protagonists in your book, where he really moves the country towards accepting involvement in this war and uses some tactics that are, you know, especially regarding the Greer, the destroyer of the Greer, that are, you know, manipulative, let's just say it. And it was part of his personality to kind of, you mentioned, you know, that he kept his cards very close to the vest for the most part.
Yeah, so history and historians agree with you that FDR was one of America's greatest presidents. And they agree, and I agree, that Roosevelt's leadership of the United States during World War II was a very large part of that greatness. But when you look at how that came about, when you look at sort of see the sausage being made, then you realize that Roosevelt accomplished his goals by means that don't really stand up to scrutiny. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is that it's always the case that in hindsight, it's hard to remember that there were alternative courses that seemed actually viable and reasonable. This is more true with America's participation in World War II, because from the American perspective, World War II turned out very well. And especially at the end of the war, when Americans understood what the German Nazi regime involved, including the Holocaust and the massacre of millions, then Americans were even more convinced of the moral rectitude of what they had done. And to the extent that they realized after the fact that Roosevelt had played a little bit fast and loose with some of the facts, they were willing to forgive him for that because of the monstrous evil that the United States had overcome. Even so, and especially, as you point out, we are now in a period when Americans are beginning to reconsider the attitude that they adopted at the end of the debate that I described. So the debate, as you accurately say, takes place from 1939 to 1941, and it's ended definitively when the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, because then the United States is at war. Debate ends. The United States is in the war. But the striking thing about that conclusion was how persistent, how strong it was for the next 80 years. It got to the point where it was nearly impossible to imagine that anyone who had argued against intervention in World War II before Pearl Harbor, before this happened, could have had logic or morality or any kind of sincerity or patriotism on his side. And I try to take the reader back to the time before all of that happened, when in fact, as I outlined at the very beginning, Americans began this period overwhelmingly opposed to the idea of intervention. But after Pearl Harbor, they're overwhelmingly in favor of intervention. Now, it didn't happen just overnight, and Pearl Harbor didn't come simply out of the blue. It was a result of a series of steps taken by the Roosevelt administration and, of course, by the Japanese that got the United States there. And so I wanted to take the readers back to the time when nobody knew how this was going to turn out, and when it was entirely possible, indeed it was appealing, to listen to the other side of the story, if only because even today, one might very well conclude that the United States needs to remain the leader of the world. The United States is the linchpin of international order. Maybe that's the conclusion you come to. But if you do, I think you need to make it in terms of evidence available today. Though the interventionists, I will call them, and these a vast majority of American presidents from Roosevelt forward, they've sort of been dining out on Roosevelt's victory over Charles Lindbergh, the other protagonist in this debate, and saying, well, okay, that sort of ended it. We don't have to question it anymore. Well, 1940 was a long time ago. Nobody's alive, really, who was involved in those debates. And whatever evidence was available then is long out of date. So if people decide that the United States ought to remain involved in the world, then they ought to make the argument, but with fresh evidence from today, not with evidence. Not they can't just get away with saying Hitler was a bad guy. Therefore, the United States in 2025 needs to remain involved in the world.
That's the great public service you provided in this book, and that we live in times when everybody just chooses their own media to back up their own viewpoints. And you do, as you said, take us back to consider both sides. And that was what really endeared me to this book. And I can't emphasize that enough to our listeners. Our region, the Midwest, the Heartland, plays a pretty big role in this, because we produce one of the other protagonists, Charles Lindbergh. And he was kind of, in some ways, an unlikely leader by temperament and by his background. But talk a little bit about how he came forward as a son of the Midwest to be the leading spokesperson.
So when I decided to write the story of this debate, I basically needed a protagonist on each side. The protagonist for intervention, the obvious choice, was Franklin Roosevelt. He's president of the United States. You know, he's going to be a player here. But Charles Lindbergh was the odd one out, because Lindbergh was not an elected official. He despised politics. He did not think of himself as a political debater. He was a celebrity. He was a celebrity from the time he flew across the Atlantic solo in 1927. And Americans took him to its heart because he was that Midwestern boy who could be every mother and father wanted to have a son to grow up like Charles Lindbergh. He was unassuming. He was modest. He was quiet. He was good looking. And that last part was crucial because this was in the era when newsreels were the way people got their news. These are miniature movies that were made by the movie studios. And they summarized the news of the week, and they were typically played on Saturday when people would go to the movies and watch them during intermission before or after the movies. And so here's Charles Lindbergh. He's the hero that Americans really like. And he wasn't just an American hero. He was a world hero because he accomplished this great feat that mankind had been trying to do, fly across the Atlantic. And then Lindbergh became a real star-crossed hero when in the early 1930s, he and his wife lost their infant son, Charles Jr., who had been kidnapped and murdered. This is because of the newsreels. This is the emergence of what we have come to call the paparazzi. They're really nosy photographers. The news people are trying to get right in your face with their cameras. And this, the crime was called the crime of the century, and the trial was the trial of the century. So everybody knew Lindbergh. Lindbergh was one of the most recognizable faces, but nobody thought of him as a politician. Now, he was the anti-politician, but when, upon the outbreak of war in Europe in 1939, when Franklin Roosevelt immediately asked Congress to revise the neutrality legislation to allow the United States to send weapons, to ship weapons to the British and the French, Lindbergh, who, by the way, his father had been a member of Congress from Minnesota in the First World War, he said, uh-oh, we're starting down the same path we went down before. And Lindbergh made this conclusion, as much as he disliked politics, that conscience and his sense of duty as a citizen, as an American patriot, required him to speak out and to say that Roosevelt is taking us down the wrong path. And initially, it was simply a matter of political difference of opinion. The president believes this, I'm going to believe this. Now, Lindbergh was the one who became the spokesperson because he was famous. So everybody in the principal medium of the day was radio. And so people in radio, they were happy to put Lindbergh on the air because they knew he would draw an audience, they'd sell commercials and all that other stuff. So he said, I'd like to give a talk, in opposition to what the talk that Franklin Roosevelt had just given about selling weapons to the belligerents. And so he goes on the air. And as the historian, I knew about Lindbergh. I knew, the story of this, but I had never taken the time to read Lindbergh's speeches. You can listen to some of them. They're, on various places in YouTube, and listen to them. And I was surprised at what a good job he did. He laid out his speeches, produced his evidence. The logical reasoning was sound, and he made a pretty convincing argument. And for me, this was just great because I set this up as a debate. The book is really written almost as a debate, and I want to have both sides give their strongest arguments, point of view. Now, one of the things I'll point out here is that, as you alluded to earlier, when people write about this, they almost, even professional historians, when they go into this, they go into this assuming that Franklin Roosevelt was right. And therefore, they just pay sort of lip service to Lindbergh, and they don't take him very seriously. In fact, more than that, they often consider him to be this pernicious influence. And not only pernicious, but because he opposed Roosevelt, they labeled him, and people in Roosevelt's time did too, they labeled him a Nazi sympathizer. Here's somebody who wants Germany to win, which was not true. But so what I need to do is I want, both sides to hear the argument. And I was pleased in writing this that I myself, when I would listen to Roosevelt's argument, I say, well, that's a pretty good argument. Maybe we ought to do that. But then Lindbergh would offer his rejoinder. I say, well, wait a minute, that's a pretty good argument too. And so I realized that my readers will know how the story turns out. The United States does enter World War II. So Lindbergh's going to lose. But the question is, and my task as the author, is to try to, I won't say keep them in suspense, but allow them to at least momentarily forget that they know how it turns out. And that, okay, this argument, maybe we should have done that. It's a little bit like James Cameron, the movie director, was asked about, the Titanic. How do you make it dramatic? He says, well, You know, there's a challenge here because everybody who goes into the movie theater knows the ship's going down before the end of the movie. But if you can make a drama out of that, if you can make the characters who are involved come alive, then you've got a story. And that's what I really tried to do. So I tried to take Roosevelt seriously, and I show the strength of his argument. I show the underhandedness of some of his techniques. I try to bring Lindbergh alive. I show the strength of his arguments. I show the quirkiness of some of his beliefs, quirkiness that caused some people to think that he's a raving lunatic. But to make the story, almost to keep the reader in suspense until the end.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm just thrilled to have as my guest today the eminent historian H.W. Brands, talking about his latest book, America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War. The way you just described that, it makes me think of the Lincoln-Douglas debates in some ways, because that's the way you wrote the book. And again, for our listeners, it is. I'm reading this as somebody who always believed in the cause of World War II. Again, my dad served, Greatest Generation. But when you read this book, I was really struck how powerful Lindbergh's arguments were. I mean, we got these two oceans separating us. Why are we getting involved over there again? We did before, and now they're back at war. When does this stop? Folks out there, you know, we're dealing with these issues again. And this book, it really lends itself to a consideration of both sides. And I hope people do take that seriously. I was struck by, and I didn't know this, I guess maybe I slept through history class when this was being discussed, but the extent to which Britain really manipulated public opinion here to the point of forgery and other things, that disturbed me a little bit.
Yeah, so the British, for very good reasons from their point of view, the British were fighting for their lives. They were under air assault from Germany. They were worrying about a German amphibious attack on Britain. So from their point of view, almost anything they did was justified, you know, to keep their country alive. Well, what they did was they established a propaganda bureau in the United States. And surreptitiously, they fed information to editors, to members of Congress. They planted stories in the media to manipulate the way Americans perceive things. They made it really easy for supporters of American intervention alongside Britain to get information, get the story out. They made it difficult for opponents like Lindbergh to make their case. And they did this with the surreptitious cooperation of the Roosevelt administration. So Roosevelt is taking the position that the United States is not involved. He didn't go so far as to say that we're morally neutral, but we're politically neutral, we're legally neutral. But nonetheless, he allowed the British to conduct this propaganda, and he had one of his closest aides, William Donovan, as a liaison with the top British propaganda officer. And so it was really clear. Oh, I should add, during all of this, Roosevelt carried on a top secret correspondence with Winston Churchill, the British prime minister. Now, if the public had known about this, if the public had known that Churchill was feeding Roosevelt information to therefore feed to the American people to make it appear that the United States needed to side with Britain, they probably would have viewed this quite differently. And it was for this reason that Roosevelt kept this correspondence quite secret and kept his toleration for the British propaganda a secret. I want to actually come back to something that you suggested earlier, and that was, and maybe your audience will appreciate this, support for American intervention in the war was strongest on the East Coast. And the East Coast, yeah, it's much closer to Britain, and it was just sort of, you couldn't quite see across the Atlantic, but it was easier to understand that Europe was there. But those people who were skeptical, including Lindbergh with his own Midwestern roots, lived in the Midwest. And in fact, the big city that was in the heart of the anti-interventionist movement was Chicago. And so there was a very strong anti-interventionist movement. The anti-interventionists were subsequently labeled isolationists. Now, this was a pejorative term. It wasn't accurate. So Lindbergh and the other anti-interventionists did not say that the United States should have no dealings with the rest of the world. They just said America should do it on America's own terms. And Lindbergh was by no means a pacifist. He wasn't opposed to war. In fact, he advocated something like a Monroe Doctrine on steroids, where the United States would proclaim that it would defend every square inch of North and South America. His point was that the United States must defend itself, but not defend itself in the middle of Europe, defend itself closer to American shores. It's more defensible. And the United States would not then get involved in and responsible for the policies of allies. So when Roosevelt talked about this war being a war for democracy, Lindbergh pointed out, well, you want us to join the side of Britain. Britain is an empire. Tell those hundreds of millions of people who live in British and the India that this is a war for democracy, and they'll just laugh at you. No, this is a war for British imperialism. And after the United States started sending lend-lease aid to the Soviet Union, then Lindbergh said, democracy, now it's a war for communism. And so Lindbergh made a point of pointing out the contradictions in the case that Roosevelt was making. And it was, there's one last thing, and this is sort of a timeless issue. Lindbergh said, especially when Roosevelt ran for an unprecedented third term for president in 1940, something that had never been done and had been, as a de facto matter, ruled out of bounds. George Washington had quit after two terms, and so every other president had to quit after two terms. But Roosevelt took the occasion, took the advantage of the war in Europe to say, well, the country needs me. The country, you know, needs a firm hand at the tiller and all of this stuff. And Lindbergh said, if you do this, if you go down this path, and basically speaking to members of Congress, but also to voters, you will be handing more power to the president. And gradually, Congress will lose its control over American foreign policy. And all of America will be at the mercy of a president's decision, a president's whim over what we should do in foreign affairs and whether we should go to war. Now, in this case, Lindbergh was very prescient. The last time Congress has declared war was right after Pearl Harbor. And the United States has fought several wars since then, but they've always been simply by the decision of the president. And we live at a time when, you know, the president of the United States is doing all sorts of things. And in some cases, with the cooperation of Congress, some cases Congress really can't stop it. But Lindbergh said, this is the path that we are going to go down if you heed what Roosevelt says. So regardless of what one thinks about American entry into World War II itself, this idea that that path led toward the direction of much greater centralization of power in the person of the president, that's something that believers in democracy and constitutional rule ought to pay close attention to.
As I mentioned, the book, again, the heartland, the Midwest plays a big role in this book. You know, Lindbergh's roots in Minnesota. And Chicago is the hub of non-interventionist sentiment, of course. But also here comes the fateful Lindbergh speech in Des Moines. And what's really interesting for our listeners, you've got all these dates in mind. We all know December 7th, 1941 is the day of the Pearl Harbor invasion and all. But you find September 11th, which of course has our own modern connotations, but September 11th of 1941 really plays a big role this day in this debate between Roosevelt and Lindbergh.
And it has a lot to do with the cloud over Lindbergh's reputation until today. So Lindbergh was frustrated by the fact that Roosevelt successfully got the United States closer and closer to war. And he thought, well, this is not reflective of the interests of the American people as whole. And he'd been thinking about the various groups that had been lobbying to get the United States into the war. And he mostly kept that to himself in his speeches until he got to Des Moines. And he realized that the tide was moving against him. And he said, I understand that this is going to cause a political explosion, but I got to say it. So in Des Moines, he says that there are three groups that are trying to get the United States into the war. The first group, he said, was the British. Now, Lindbergh didn't know the details of the British propaganda machine, but he said the British want us in the war. And it's perfectly understandable that they do. I don't begrudge them their desire to get us in the war. They're fighting for their lives. Okay. But the policies of Britain should not dictate the policies of the United States. The second group, said Lindbergh, are American Jews. And they want the United States into the war for very understandable reasons. Their family, their friends, they're being thrown into concentration camps, they're being oppressed in Europe. And they have every right to their opinion. But again, I don't think their opinion should dictate American policy. The third group, said Lindbergh, was the Roosevelt administration. In fact, Lindbergh was most bitter in his criticism of the Roosevelt administration because he said, President Roosevelt is using this war to aggrandize himself, to steal authority from Congress, and to make himself almost a dictator. So the next day, the headlines summarized Lindbergh's speech, but the thing they zeroed in on was his accusation that Jews wanted America to get into the war. And on its face, it was a relatively uncontroversial thing to say. It was true that many Jews did want the United States. He added the Jews had a large voice in the media, which in fact was true, especially it involved the movie studios and the newsreels. But the very idea that Roosevelt would inject religion into this, and that's the way it was usually phrased, Roosevelt would inject religion into this debate when Americans should all be united. And Lindbergh was, he wasn't surprised, but he still was dismayed by this because, in fact, he went to Herbert Hoover, another Iowan by birth, and also an anti-interventionist. And he said, well, what did I say that was wrong? And Hoover, of course, who was a veteran politician, he said, it's not that what you said was wrong. It was that you were wrong to say it. And so at that point, emerged the idea that the reason Lindbergh was opposed to American intervention was that he was this raving anti-Semite and that he endorsed the policies of Hitler that led to the Holocaust. Now, that was a gross slander against Lindbergh, and that wasn't true. He was sort of mildly anti-Semitic, as very many people were, in the sense he didn't want, you know, Jews in his country club, that sort of thing. But to condemn him for the Holocaust was ludicrous. But that's the part, that's the shadow that hung over Lindbergh. And it was just a couple of months after that, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and the United States is in the war. I should add at this point that as soon as the United States went to war, Lindbergh immediately volunteered to fight. You know, he had opposed the idea of the war until America went to war, but then he volunteered to fight. Except Roosevelt said, no, we're not going to let you in here, because Roosevelt didn't want his most bitter critic going off and becoming a war hero, as he probably would have.
We're just about out of time. I will just share with our audience, I guess, instead of putting it in question form, that I'm glad that you've resisted the temptation to get into a long ending chapter on the what's going on today with the Trump administration. I think that's for us to figure out. And I'm really glad that you did that because, you know, again, our listeners, if you want to know Dr. Brand's opinion on all this, well, he doesn't give it. I think it's more just read this, absorb it, and then apply it to today. And I think, again, this book is very, very valuable in that sense. You've done a great public service, I think, in putting this together and in a very objective fashion.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because that is exactly my goal. I don't want to presume for my readers to tell them what verdict they should render on all this. What I do try to do is give them the evidence, give them the arguments, and let them choose for themselves. Because I don't think that the judgment that people will make is based primarily on the evidence. It is based a lot on the values that people bring to the debate themselves. And that's why I think the debate in 1940 over whether the United States entered World War II is of use today, because we're debating the same issue. The narrow issue in 1940 was, should the United States enter the war against Germany? But the larger issue is, what is the American role in the world? What ought it to be? And that's the same debate we're having today. We're having it in a renewed and sharper way than we've had really since Pearl Harbor. And so it's high time to sort of reframe and to talk about this. Readers, listeners, they can come to whatever conclusions they want, but the decisions will be better if the decisions are based on evidence and on logic rather than just on emotion and something you inherited from somebody else.
H.W. Brands, author of America First, Roosevelt versus Lindbergh in the Shadow of War, a book highly recommended. Thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest today on Heartland Politics.
You're welcome, Robin. Good to talk to you.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.